Chapter 4 Havoc. Beware of surprise. You know how the Indians fight us. George Washington. The sad and dreadful havoc of our army at the westward cast a gloom over us all. Abigail Adams. 1. For more than 3 years, Rufus Putnam had devoted all he had in time and strength to his frontier settlement on the Ohio, and despite continuing setbacks and adversities of every variety, he had seen progress such as had, until then, been only talked about or dreamed of. Now, suddenly, all seemed threatened with annihilation. The Indians were claiming that by the time spring arrived, there would be no more smoke coming from a settler's cabin anywhere along the Ohio. As Putnam himself said, "A horrid, savage war stares us in the face." How or where it would begin, how long it might go on, there was no telling. The situation at Marietta was critical. Most of the troops stationed at Fort Harmer had been sent downriver at the time of General Harmer's unfortunate attack on the Indians, leaving behind only a small detachment comprised mainly of invalids. But Putnam also knew that in the face of adversity, the people of Marietta had, as said, spunk to the backbone. On January 5th, he called a special meeting in the Northwest Blockhouse, where it was resolved that additional fortifications were necessary for the safety and defense of the settlement, these to be built without delay on the Point at Marietta and at Belpre, and that 6 experienced backwoods hunters be hired as rangers or spies to go out daily into the surrounding wilderness over a route of roughly 20 miles to watch for any signs of a surprise attack. Meantime, all who could in Marietta were to take up residence after dark inside the stockade, which itself was to be much improved by additional defenses. Under orders from Governor St. Clair, Campus Martius was to be kept under strict discipline. The men, divided into squads, were called to their posts at daylight, while through the night 4 other squads kept watch at the bastions. Sentries were set, and the watchword cried every half hour. Cannon were mounted in the northeast and southwest blockhouses, and especially to be fired as alarm signals to residents at home or at work in the surrounding fields, who were then to go directly to their alarm posts within the walls. Rufus Putnam was said to have had a stormy temper. It was thought to have been one of his few human flaws, but seldom, if ever, seen. Then, on January 6th, in a letter to the governor of Massachusetts, Caleb Strong, the general exploded in outrage at the apparent indifference back home to the situation in which he and the people of Marietta found themselves. "Because of the prudence of our people, the friendship with which we treated the natives, we remained in a state of general quiet without any apprehension from the Delawares and other tribes till the Harmer expedition. If therefore we had no claim to the protection of government before, I trust we have now. For a parent to invite his children to gather plums under a hornet's nest and then beat the nest without giving them notice to get out of the way or covering them, while he provokes the hornets, has something so cruel in its nature that the mind revolts at the idea. I ask, are not allegiance and protection reciprocal? Have we not given the most unequivocal proof of our allegiance and love of our country with constitutional government through the Revolution and ever since? Why then, in the name of God, will you not protect us?" 2 days later, on January 8th, Putnam sent another frantic letter, this time to President Washington. "The situation had become truly critical," he wrote. "The garrison at Fort Harmer, consisting by then of little more than 20 men, offered no protection. The number of men in the settlement capable of bearing arms did not exceed 287, and many of these were badly armed. The situation of our people is nearly as follows. At Marietta are about 80 houses in the distance of 1 mile, with scattering houses for 3 miles up the Ohio. A set of mills at Duck Creek, 4 miles distant, and another mill 2 miles from Marietta. Up the Muskingum, 22 miles distant, is a settlement of about 20 families. And on Wolf Creek, about 18 miles from Marietta, is a set of mills where are 5 families. Down the Ohio, and opposite Little Kanawha, commences the settlement of Belpre, which extends on the bank of the river with little interruption about 12 miles, and contains 6 blockhouses and can muster about 60 fighting men. Before the late disaster, Big Bottom, we had several other settlements which had commenced and are now entirely abandoned. I beg leave, with the greatest deference, to observe that unless government speedily sends a body of troops for our protection, we are a ruined people. And only observe further that our present situation is truly distressing. I do therefore most earnestly implore the protection of government for myself and friends inhabiting these wilds of America. To this we consider ourselves justly entitled, and rest assured that so far as you, sir, have the means in your power, you will grant it. In yet another letter written the same day to Secretary of War Henry Knox, Putnam said much the same as he had to the President, but adding, "Better that the government disband their troops now in the Northwest country and give it up altogether, than be wasting the public money in supporting a few troops totally inadequate to the purpose of giving peace to the territory." The weather was cold and miserable, with ice on the Ohio and extreme tension everywhere, as work on the defenses proceeded with all possible speed. Still, nothing out of the ordinary happened as the weeks passed. Nothing until March. On Sunday, March 13th, 2 of the Rangers employed to keep watch against surprise attack, Captain Joseph Rogers and Edward Henderson, on return from duty up the Muskingum, were suddenly attacked 1 mile north of the stockade. 4 Indians rose up from behind a log and shot Rogers through the chest. As he fell, Rogers told Henderson to run for his life. He himself was a dead man. Henderson managed to escape, but Rogers was later found both dead and scalped. And there was to be much talk about him and the ominous dream he had had the night before. Rogers was a veteran soldier from Pennsylvania in his 50s who had seen much. He it was who had accompanied General Parsons in the canoe when Parsons was killed trying to shoot the rapids on the Beaver River. Calm by nature, he was not one known for flights of fancy, but as he had told others earlier that morning, he was much shaken by a dream he had had the night before, that he was to kill an Indian that day, or be killed himself. On his way out the gate, he had remarked to the guards, "Well, boys, today we take a scalp, or lose one." Alarm guns and cannon were fired at the stockade. It was not just that Rogers had been killed, but that the Indians were said to have chased Henderson all the way to the gate. "All was consternation," wrote Joseph Barker, who with his family was still quartered in the garrison, and who went on to describe the scene in his own distinctive way. "Everyone made immediately for his alarm post. The first person for admittance at the central blockhouse was Colonel E. Sproat, with a box of papers. Then came some young men with their arms. Then a woman, with her bed and children. Then came old Mr. William Moulton from Newburyport, age 70, with his leather apron full of old goldsmith's tools and tobacco. His daughter Anna brought the china teapot, cups, and saucers. Lydia brought the great Bible. But when all were in, Mother was missing. Where was Mother? She must be killed. No, says Lydia. Mother said she would not leave a house looking so, She would put things a little to rights, and then she would come. Directly, Mother came, bringing the looking glass, knives, forks, and spoons, etc. All returned to their homes in the morning, and a party from the Point and Campus Martius went out about 10 o'clock and brought in Captain Rogers and buried him. With the advance of spring, more scouts were ambushed on duty. Indians killed Benoni Hurlburt at Belpre, James Kelly at Belleville, and captured his small son, Joseph. On the Virginia side of the Ohio, 7 miles from Marietta, 4 white men were killed, 3 others taken prisoners. On June 16th, just above the mouth of the Muskingum, the elderly Matthew Kerr from Ireland, one of the earliest of Marietta settlers, was gunned down and scalped. It was a loss deeply felt in the settlement, and shortly afterward, that summer of 1791, Kerr's son, Hamilton, and several others happened on a party of 6 Indians near Mill Creek, and, as would be said, Hamilton was unable to resist the opportunity to gratify his revenge. He not only shot and killed an Indian, but cut off his head, fixed it to the end of a pole, and marched it back to the stockade. Horace Nye, one of Ichabod Nye's several sons, would remember as a small boy going out the gate with his mother and seeing Kerr and others bringing home the trophy. "Some whites are more savage than the Indians," Horace would write, recalling the scene. In Philadelphia, meantime, President Washington made certain Congress became well aware of General Putnam's call for help. There was talk of raising an army of 4,000 or more. On May 3rd, Congress, having decided something had to be done, authorized Governor St. Clair to raise a force of 2,000 to put down the Native Confederacy and to do so without delay. The major general appointed to command the army was Arthur St. Clair, who was also to remain governor of the territory. It was a tall order. The government had virtually no troops or money, and the Ohio frontier, the Far West, was in itself no easy matter to contend with, Indians or no Indians. And then there was the choice of St. Clair to take command. A native of Scotland, who had come to America as a young officer in the British Army, he had married an American, Phoebe Bayard of Boston, and with money inherited from her estate, purchased 4,000 acres in the Ligonier Valley of western Pennsylvania, making him the largest resident landowner west of the Allegheny Mountains. At the start of the Revolution, he had enlisted at once in the American Army. Rising rapidly from the rank of colonel to brigadier general, he was with Washington at the battles of Trenton and Princeton. However, when put in command of Fort Ticonderoga, a stronghold widely believed to be impregnable, he ordered its evacuation, a decision that, as said, filled the public mind with much dismay. Though exonerated by a court-martial that followed, he was to receive no further assignment of consequence for the remainder of the war. Many on the frontier thought him arrogant and overly determined to dominate. Further, by that spring of 1791, he was at 55, noticeably aged, overweight, and in poor health, suffering from ague and gout. Much of the time, the pain of swelling joints caused by gout was such that he could hardly walk. In early May, during a visit to Fort Washington at Cincinnati, he found the quantity of arms and other military supplies available insufficient for a major campaign. Many of those on hand were hard at work. Indeed, the fort had as much appearance of a large manufactory on the inside as it had of a military post on the outside. An armory had to be built since the arms of the detachment were nearly all in bad order. Blacksmiths, carpenters, harness makers, colliers, wheelwrights were all in great need. The expedition was supposed to have been underway by July 10th. With time running out, it became even more apparent how much had still to be done. Weeks passed. Pressure from Philadelphia grew greater. The President of the United States still continues anxious that you should at the earliest moment commence your operations, wrote Secretary of War Knox to St. Clair on August 4th, again on August 11th, and again on August 25th, Knox wrote to say how greatly the president lamented the delays. The new troops left much to be desired as to material for an army soon to embark on a campaign into the unfamiliar wilderness of enemy country. They consisted largely of men collected from the streets and jails of eastern cities, bribed into service with money and whiskey. Many of the officers, too, were seen to be totally unacquainted with the business in which they were engaged. The quartermaster and contractors in place were clearly well below standards. To General Josiah Harmer, it was a matter of astonishment that the commanding general, St. Clair, who was acknowledged to be perfectly competent, should think of hazarding the lives of so many others. But General Harmer was out of favor with the President and Secretary of War, and his views were no longer considered. The plan was to proceed north some 170 miles to the Maumee River, building a road through the dense forest as they went, all of which was certain to be slow going. But one of the few positive lessons learned from the Harmer expedition was that building such a road was possible. Little or nothing was yet known of the size or makeup of the native forces to be confronted, or who was in command. General St. Clair was known to have little knowledge of or interest in Indians, and had given the matter no serious attention. His attitude seems to have been that so long as he did not encounter the enemy, he need not worry. The problem could be dealt with if and when the occasion should arise. Until then, the worst defeat ever suffered by an army in battle with American natives occurred in 1755, during the French and Indian War. The British general Edward Braddock, in command of some 1,400 British regulars and 700 American provincials, including young George Washington, had been ambushed and slaughtered in a heavily wooded ravine about 8 miles from Pittsburgh, then the French Fort Duquesne. 33 years later, when on the way to Marietta to take up his role as the first governor of the Northwest Territory, General St. Clair had been escorted from Pittsburgh to Marietta by young Ebenezer Denny. But before departing down the Ohio, Denny took St. Clair for a visit to Braddock's Field, where the bones of the victims were still to be seen scattered through the woods. As St. Clair's new command was now organized, Denny was to be with him almost constantly. Whether they ever recalled together their long-past visit to the scene of Braddock's defeat, neither is known to have recorded. But months earlier, back in Philadelphia, at the close of a meeting between Washington, Knox, and St. Clair, just as St. Clair was about to return to Ohio to assume command, Washington's parting words to him, as Washington would recall, had been, "Beware of surprise. You know how the Indians fight us." As St. Clair organized his command, Winthrop Sargent, now to be Colonel Sargent, was his adjutant general, Major Denny his aide-de-camp. And so it was to be three from Marietta, largely in control. Most worrisome to Winthrop Sargent was the obvious lack of the essential stamina of soldiers so evident in the army itself. Picked up and recruited from the off-scourings of large towns and cities, enervated by idleness, debaucheries, and every species of vice, it was impossible they could have been made competent to the arduous duties of Indian warfare. An extraordinary aversion to service was conspicuous among them. They were, moreover, badly clothed, badly paid, and badly fed. They had signed on for $2 a month, plus a whiskey allotment. By early September, the greater part of the assembled troops were encamped on the banks of the Great Miami River, some 20 miles north of Fort Washington, where St. Clair began construction of another fortification to be named Fort Hamilton. By the end of September, the expedition that was supposed to have been underway by July 10th had still to get started, and morale among the troops grew worse by the day. On the night of October 3rd, one sergeant and 25 men deserted. The day after, 9 more followed. Finally, on October 4th, with a great roll of drums, St. Clair's army was on the march from Fort Hamilton, though not until noon because of certain deficiencies in pack horses. The army that was supposed to have numbered more than 4,000, then 2,000, now comprised approximately 1,700, and with it went some 200 camp followers, consisting of wives, mistresses, washerwomen, prostitutes, and a scattering of children with pets. 2. The advance proceeded with much racket of drums, barking dogs, cattle bellowing, and innumerable undisciplined soldiers shouting and cursing, in addition to the constant crashing of trees being felled ahead. The clamor was intended, in the hope that a lot of noise and show made on the march might deter the enemy from daring to attack so mighty a force. Progress was slow. Not only was the forest dense with giant trees, but it was a part of Ohio about which little was known. St. Clair would later explain, "We had no guides, not a single person being found in the country who had ever been through it, and both the geography and topography were utterly unknown." The army crossed the Great Miami with little delay, the river in that season being quite low. But beyond the river, clearing a way for a cavalcade of pack horses, oxen, troops, and artillery proved extremely difficult. By day's end, they had progressed all of 3 miles. On the second day, the woods everywhere were so compact as to make the opening of a road most tedious. Even when marching single file, they had to cut their way every step. Fair weather followed day after day. Still, the advance remained no better than about 4 miles a day, the country getting even rougher, crowded with giant oaks, hickory, ash, walnut, sugar maples, and a considerable portion of beech, all, as Winthrop Sargent noted, indicating a very rich land. Not until October 12th, after more than a week on the move, were the first signs of Indians seen, many tracks and the traces of camps, old and recent. The day after, the army having advanced only a mile, General St. Clair called halt, having decided they had reached an acceptable, if not ideal, location on a low knoll for another fort. By this time, they had come 68 miles from Fort Washington, 44 miles from Fort Hamilton. There the army would remain encamped for another 10 days. 200 men were put to work clearing land and laying a foundation. It was to be a small, square log fort. The good weather did not hold. Late in the day of October 14th, heavy rains fell and continued through the night, the next day, and the following night. Cold and wet. Weather very bad, recorded Major Denny. The night of October 21st came a very severe frost and ice upon the waters a half inch thick. The troops, having been issued substandard tents, suffered severely. The substandard shoes issued were by now falling apart. Food was running low, their supply of bread nearly gone, due, as Denny noted, to unpardonable mismanagement in the provisions department. Of no small concern, too, was a serious decline in liquor. To face the emergency, all the horses with the army were to be sent back to Fort Washington for supplies. When some of the men were asked to go with the horses, their reply was that if sent, they would not return. On October 23rd, two artillery men who intended to desert to the Indians were, on orders from General St. Clair, tried, sentenced, and promptly hanged. Another man was hanged for shooting a comrade, and two more found sleeping on duty were subjected to 50 lashes each. All such miseries and suffering were greatly compounded by the physical incapacities and sufferings of the commander himself, whose physical condition had worsened. The excruciating grip of the gout had gotten to the point where he could no longer walk and had to be lifted onto his horse. On October 28th, with the new fort nearly completed, a caravan of 74 horses loaded with 12,000 pounds of flour arrived, along with a few more horses loaded with clothing, and all to good effect. Clearly, the time for a decision had arrived. To push on to confront the enemy, about whom nothing was known, no matter the condition of morale or inexperience of the army, or call off the campaign and make an orderly withdrawal while that was still possible. "Our prospects are gloomy," wrote Sargent, "with the difficulties of transportation every day increasing by the season, and to become still greater as we add to our distance, may make events fatal to the whole army." To what degree Sargent and Denny voiced such grave concerns to St. Clair is not known, but with so much at stake, it seems unlikely they would have held back. And just as surely, St. Clair's past decision to abandon Fort Ticonderoga and the disapproval it had brought down on him must have figured now in his decision to push on, which, as he confided to Sargent, he saw as the one and only way to hold the army together. It was his secret design, he said, to get them deeper into enemy country, where the men may be afraid to return. As they were soon to learn, the force that lay in wait was large, highly experienced in wilderness warfare, and led by two exceptional commanders, the Miami war chief, Little Turtle, who had so roundly defeated General Harmer, and the Shawnee war chief, Blue Jacket, regarded by his contemporaries as a leader of exceptional wisdom and courage. In addition, they were thoroughly supplied with information about the advancing army by an ample number of scouts that included the young Shawnee warrior, Tecumseh. In total, the native force numbered some 1,000 warriors, representing 8 more tribes other than the Miami and Shawnee: Delawares and Wyandots, Ottawas, Kickapoos, Chippewas, Potawatomis, Mohawks from Canada, and Creeks from the South. Among them also, reportedly as an observer only, was the infamous Revolutionary War turncoat Simon Girty, who had been captured in boyhood by Senecas, raised by them, and was still in the employ of the British. The Indians were never in greater heart to meet their enemy, nor more sure of their success, Girty wrote. They are determined to drive them to the Ohio. Incredibly, for General St. Clair, the unseen enemy was still a matter of little concern. On the first day of November, in a dispatch to Secretary Knox, he was happy to report, "The few Indians that have been seen were hunters only, who we fell upon by accident." The army by then was again on the move, having pushed on in fair weather the morning of October 30th. A small contingent of soldiers, all men unable to march, had been left to maintain the new stockade, Fort Jefferson. In one day, October 31st, no fewer than 60 of those on the march deserted. As troubling as almost anything was the specter of the commander whose physical condition had so deteriorated that he now had to be carried like a corpse in a litter, strung between two horses. During the march of November 2nd, in bitter weather all day, the army, hungry, cold, reduced by sickness and desertion, made 8 miles. On November 3rd, in a small flight of snow, it marched another 8 miles through low, damp woodlands to a cramped piece of rising ground close by a branch of the Wabash River, and there the advance came to a halt. During the course of the night, detachments of soldiers were supposed to have gone out to determine the enemy's whereabouts and strength, but did not, on the excuse they were too tired. As the night passed, separate shots were heard, fired principally by our own sentinels, sometimes, no doubt, at the enemy, wrote Winthrop Sargent, but oftener, probably, without any object whatever. 3. The following morning, Friday, November 4th, was intensely cold, but as Sargent recorded, the sky unclouded. The sun was not yet up. Campfires were blazing. The troops had already paraded as usual and been dismissed for breakfast when, only minutes after sunrise, the woods to the front on the other side of the Wabash suddenly erupted with the yells of Indians, a sound that most of the soldiers, including Colonel Sargent, had never heard until then. Not terrible, as has been represented, Sargent thought, but more resembling an infinitude of horse bells suddenly opening to you than any other sound I could compare it to. All at once, a great number of painted warriors burst from cover and started firing, and almost at once the militia positioned several hundred yards in front, beyond the river, turned and fled. Then Sargent wrote, "Close upon the heels of the flying militia followed the Indians, estimated to have numbered at least 300. The rest of the troops were under arms almost instantly, and smart fire was returned just as fire from the enemy began coming in from all sides. It was like nothing the army had been prepared for. Such was the noise, smoke, and speed of all that was happening, that all sense of order or direction vanished in an instant. The enemy from the front filed off to the right and left and completely surrounded the camp, killed and cut off nearly all the guards, and approached close to the lines," wrote Ebenezer Denny. "They advanced from one tree, log, or stump to another, under cover of the smoke of our fire. The artillery and musketry made a tremendous noise, but did little execution. The Indians seemed to brave everything, and when fairly fixed around us, they made no noise other than their fire, which they kept up very constant and which seldom failed to tell. At one point, they took possession of part of the encampment, but on being exposed on what was comparatively clear ground, they were soon repulsed by troops led by General St. Clair himself on foot, despite all his agonies. When the attack came, he had been in his camp bed. He had hurriedly put on his cocked hat and greatcoat and tottered out of his tent. With the help of 3 or 4 men, he had tried to mount a horse, but the animal, frightened by the gunfire, kept bolting, then was shot in the head and instantly killed. When another horse rushed into place, it too was shot and killed, before St. Clair could be hoisted into the saddle. Refusing to wait any longer, he hobbled off on foot, his pains forgotten, he later claimed. The battalions in the rear charged several times, but the attackers, utterly fearless, only turned and fired back. Indeed, they seemed not to fear anything we could do, wrote Ebenezer Denny. They could skip out of reach of the bayonet and return as they pleased. They were visible only when raised by a charge. The ground was literally covered with the dead. Atrocities were to be seen everywhere. Wounded men had been scalped while still alive, then flung onto campfires. Dead settler women lay scattered, some of their bodies cut in two, breasts cut off, then heaped on campfires. "The Indians fought like hellhounds," said another soldier. But then so, too, did a number of soldiers, When an Indian fell wounded and tried to crawl away, a colonel named Dark, his sword drawn, rushed after him and cut his head off. Ohio, with its promise of the Garden of Eden, had suddenly become hell on earth. "I wish I could describe that battle," one rifleman later wrote, "but I have not the power. It seems like a wild, horrid dream in which whites and savages were all mixed together in mad confusion, melting away in smoke, fire, and blood amid groans, shouts, yells, shrieks." The wounded were taken to the center, where it was thought to be most safe, and where many of those who had quit their posts unhurt had crowded together. General St. Clair, with others of the officers, tried to rally these men, and twice succeeded in moving them back to the lines where, being left with few experienced officers, they gave up the fight and crowded back to the center again. Denny, who was in the thick of it, would write about all that he saw. Nothing, it seems, could induce those concentrated at the center to do anything in their own defense. "As our lines were deserted, the Indians contracted theirs until their shot centered from all points, and now meeting with little opposition, took more deliberate aim and did great execution." Exposed as to a crossfire, men and officers were seen falling in every direction. The distress, too, of the wounded made the scene such as can scarcely be conceived. A retreat had to be called. The battle had become a one-sided slaughter. A few minutes more, and it would be too late. In Denny's words, delay was death. The only hope was that the savages would be so taken up with plunder of the camp as not to follow after. No preparation could be made. Numbers of brave men must be left a sacrifice. There was no alternative. Shortly past 9 o'clock, St. Clair gave the order. In a matter of minutes, the army was in full, desperate retreat, a scene of utter panic and chaos. Guns, ammunition, knapsacks were thrown aside, littering the road for miles. A great number of the wounded were left behind, including General Richard Butler, who had been notably harsh with Indians in previous treaty negotiations, and who had often been criticized for knowing so little about the Indians. Too severely wounded to be moved, Butler was left propped against a tree. Found by several of the warriors, he was tomahawked, scalped, and reportedly his heart cut out and divided into pieces to be distributed among the different tribes that fought in the battle. Many more of the wounded left behind, men, women, and children, were massacred, their bodies desecrated. One of the Delaware chiefs taking part in the battle was old Captain Pipe, who had once given such a warm welcome to Rufus Putnam and the others on their arrival at Marietta. According to his own account, he now distinguished himself differently, slaughtering white men until his arm was weary with the work. The hope that the enemy might pursue the army a short distance only, so exultant would they be over their triumph and the spoils left behind at the camp, proved to be what happened. The escaping survivors of the battle were pursued little more than a few miles, and by only a few Indians, though those rushing headlong to get away were unaware of this. Winthrop Sargent had been hit 3 times by gunshot, and was to carry 2 musket balls in his hips for the rest of his life. Yet he had kept in the thick of the battle the whole time. As too had General St. Clair, who came through bearing no sign of it except that 8 musket balls passed through his coat and hat. So exhausted and in such pain was he that he could barely sit straight, let alone stand. He had been hoisted onto the back of a comparably exhausted pack horse that could move no faster than a walk, and so the general had no choice but to follow at the rear of the desperate march. He, too, saw the whole scene as a total disaster. But then what could be done? Having fought in and survived a battle lasting nearly 4 hours, having had little or nothing to eat since the night before, many of them suffering from wounds, the men moved on, hour after hour, mile after mile, for 29 miles to reach Fort Jefferson just after dark, only to find no supplies of food or medicine at hand, which left no choice but to keep going. Those of the wounded or others unable to go on were lodged as comfortably as possible within the fort. Accordingly, recorded Ebenezer Denny, we set out a little after 10 and continued our route through the night until within an hour of daylight, then halted and waited for day and until the rear came up. Moved on again about 9 o'clock. The morning of the 5th, we met the convoy from Fort Hamilton, stopped to provide a sufficiency to subsist us to Fort Hamilton, sent the remainder on to Fort Jefferson under an additional escort of a captain and 60 men. Proceeded, and at First Water Creek, halted, partly cooked and ate for the first time since the night preceding the action. At 1 o'clock, moved on, and continued our route until 9 at night, when we halted and made fires within 15 miles of Fort Hamilton. Marched again, just before day, November 6th. The general, soon after, rode on to the Fort Washington. Troops reached there in the afternoon. The battered, pitiful soldiers found little room awaiting them in the barracks. Told to set up camp nearby, they found themselves provided with almost nothing in the way of tents or food. So they moved into the village of Cincinnati. Every house in this town is filled with drunken soldiers, and there seems one continued scene of confusion, reported Winthrop Sergeant. For days, wounded soldiers kept staggering into camp, some in horrid condition. One was without his scalp, his skull crushed in two places by a tomahawk. General St. Clair was being housed within Fort Washington. So weak and exhausted, he would not leave his room for 2 weeks. St. Clair's defeat, as the battle came to be known, had been a total disaster, worse than any suffered by the American Army during the entire Revolution, and the greatest defeat of an army at the hands of natives until then, including Braddock's defeat. According to the count tabulated by Ebenezer Denny, the army losses numbered 623 dead, including 39 officers. In addition, an estimated 200 others, men, women, and children, were killed. In all, only 3 women survived. This made a total of 1,094 dead and wounded, or well over half of the 1,400 Americans present at the scene. The Indians lost no more than 21 dead and 40 wounded. They had also acquired from the soldiers' abandoned encampment some 1,200 muskets, 163 axes, 8 cannon, baggage wagons, and a mountain of camp equipment. Exhausted and distraught as he was, Major Denny tried to determine in his mind why the massive effort had gone so wrong, and kept coming back to the warnings that General Harmer, with all his experience with failure, had voiced at the start. On November 9th, in the privacy of his journal, Denny wrote at length on the matter, and while never fixing the blame on General St. Clair by name, clearly he saw it as a case of repeated bad judgment and bad decisions made one after another from the beginning. Well before the St. Clair campaign got underway, General Harmer had seen with what material the bulk of the army was composed, and that with such recruits, defeat was inevitable. Men collected from the streets and prisons of the cities, hurried out into the enemy's country, and with the officers commanding them, totally unacquainted with the business in which they were engaged. It was utterly impossible they could be otherwise. Besides, not any one department was sufficiently prepared. Both quartermaster and contractors were extremely deficient. It was a matter of astonishment to Harmer that the commanding general, St. Clair, who was acknowledged to be perfectly competent, should think of hazarding, with such people, and under such circumstances, his reputation and life and the lives of so many others, knowing too, as both did, the enemy with whom he was going to contend, an enemy brought up from infancy to war, and perhaps superior to an equal number of the best men that could be taken against them. For one officer only did Denny voice praise, and that was Winthrop Sargent, the revolutionary officer who remained constantly on the alert and took upon himself the burden of everything. But, he wrote, there was one further, most important matter that, if not entirely neglected, should have had far more serious attention. This was a knowledge of the collected force and situation of the enemy. Of this, we were perfectly ignorant. What was left of the miserable army remained encamped in front of Fort Washington. There were days and nights of cold rain, then snow. Such officers as were sufficiently capable were busy making payrolls and preparing for their men's discharge as quickly as possible. An official dispatch reporting the defeat had gone off to Secretary Knox from General St. Clair, but whether it had been received was unknown. After another week, it was decided that someone who had been through the ordeal had to take the news in person to President Washington. The choice for this unpleasant task was Major Denny, and on the evening of November 19th, carrying a copy of the earlier dispatch to Secretary Knox, he departed on board a 14-oar barge back up the Ohio. Though Marietta and vicinity had suffered no attack by the Indians, there had been cause for considerable unrelieved tension and misery for many, including a return of smallpox and scarlet fever, which carried off 15 to 20 children. Jonathan Duvall and his wife, as one example, had suffered the loss of 3 of their children. When Major Denny brought the news of St. Clair's defeat to Marietta during a stop there, so alarmed were many, there was talk of evacuating the settlement. But, as said, these evil forebodings began to subside, and by the calm deportment and resolute counsel of the more influential and experienced men, a better spirit prevailed. Foremost and most important of such men was, most obviously, Rufus Putnam, who several days afterward was to write at length to Washington about the state of conditions in Marietta, but make no mention of St. Clair's defeat, fully conscious, as he would have been, that the first word to the president had to come from Denny. But even absent of any mention of the massive defeat of the army, it was a powerful expression of what was also being experienced day after day by many on the Ohio frontier. The letter was dated December 26, 1791. When I consider the multiplicity of business which necessarily engages your attention, it is with great reluctance I address you on the affairs of the people settled in this quarter, he began. After describing the improvements of the local fortifications that had been established, he went on to list the numerous murders committed by Indians in the near vicinity since the massacre at Big Bottom. Was it not to be feared, he asked, that the enemy's late success would bring on more bloodshed? People were leaving daily. Our numbers are few and daily decreasing. Some families and many young men have left us already, and more are going because they can get employment. Nor are we able to prevent them. All resources by which we retained them the last year are at an end, and we are scarcely able to subsist ourselves and families, much less to pay men for labor or military service. So that unless we can be assured of government protection, self-preservation dictates the propriety of getting away as soon as possible. He then proceeded with what was clearly a sore subject. But however surprising for you to hear and painful for me to relate, these people think they have very little hope from Governor St. Clair. They believe that both the governor and Mr. Sargent have, for some reason or other, conceived a prejudice against them. More than this, however, he did not express, except to say that for all the recruits stationed at Pittsburgh and Wheeling, indeed all stations on the Ohio, of any consequence, only Marietta, had received no protection of any kind. I do not wish to entertain groundless jealousies nor frighten myself with imaginary evils, but it must be allowed that a black cloud hangs over us, and God only knows when or on what devoted spot it may break. 4. As Denny was to learn on arrival in Philadelphia, the earlier dispatch had already reached Knox, who wasted no time sending it by courier to the president's residence, where the president was entertaining guests at a private Sunday dinner and wished not to be disturbed. But the president's private secretary, Tobias Lear, entered the room and whispered in the president's ear, whereupon Washington excused himself, left the table, and after reading the dispatch, rejoined the gathering as though nothing had happened. Only later would Tobias Lear recount how, after the guests had left, Washington paced up and down the room, then exploded in a fury. "It's all over," he said. "St. Clair's defeated. Routed. The officers nearly all killed. Here," he continued, his anger growing, "on this very spot, I took leave of him. 'You have your instructions,' I said, 'from the Secretary of War. I will add but one word. Beware of surprise. You know how the Indians fight us.' He went off with that as my last warning. And yet, to suffer that army to be cut to pieces, hacked, butchered, tomahawked by a surprise. The very thing I guarded him against. Oh, God. Oh, God, he is worse than a murderer. How can he answer it to his country? The blood of the slain is upon him. The curse of widows and orphans. The curse of heaven." Tobias Lear had never heard such an outburst of rage, at the end of which Washington collapsed on a sofa and sat silent. Then his voice softened. He told Lear, "This must not go beyond this room. General St. Clair shall have justice. I will receive him without displeasure. I will hear him without prejudice. He shall have full justice." During his journey from Cincinnati, Ebenezer Denny tried to banish from his mind, as much as that was possible, every idea of the slaughter and defeat of the army. To talk at all on the subject was an unpleasant task for him. At Pittsburgh, old friends there seemed to view him as having escaped from the dead. Meanwhile, word of what happened spread rapidly throughout the East, and public rage kept mounting. As early as December 10th, the New York Gazette of the United States carried a letter from Shippensburg, Pennsylvania, on the Ohio, reporting news of our army being totally defeated and 600 privates killed. The Philadelphia National Gazette, the Boston Columbian Sentinel, and the Massachusetts Spy all carried reports of dreadful carnage and chaos. Some of what appeared was inaccurate. The Gazette of the United States on December 17th described General St. Clair lying ill of the gout the whole time the battle raged, and how his guards, by dint of the bayonet, had prevented the Indians getting into his tent to butcher him. The horror and alarm over the news felt by people in all walks of life was powerfully expressed in a letter written December 18th by Abigail Adams, wife of the vice president, to an old family friend back in Boston. "The sad and dreadful havoc of our army at the westward cast a gloom over us all. Some of the best officers who remained to us after the peace have fallen here. All our Boston youths who were officers are amongst the slain. Not even Braddock's defeat is said to have caused such a slaughter. A poor, gouty, infirm general, always unsuccessful, a miserable banditry of undisciplined troops, an excellent choir of officers, who I am told went out like lambs to the slaughter, having no prospect of conquering. I apprehend much uneasiness will ensue. Arriving in Philadelphia late in the day on December 19th, after more than a month of extremely difficult travel through rain and snow nearly the whole way, Denny reported immediately to the Secretary of War. The next morning he was received by the President with attention and kindness, and following a breakfast with the President and his family, he and Washington talked at length in privacy. To what extent and in what detail he talked of all he had seen and knew remains unknown, but doubtless he reported a great deal, including the full death toll of the massacre and retreat, he being the one who made the count. In the earlier dispatch, St. Clair had mentioned by name only 5 of the officers killed, and said nothing of the 593 enlisted men, about whom Denny was obliged to report, and no doubt did, all that was known. General St. Clair did not arrive in Philadelphia until 2 months later, and was received by Washington with the same degree of courtesy and respect that Denny had been given. Formally resigning his command, St. Clair asked for an investigation by Congress into the cause of his defeat, and this led to the first congressional investigation in American history. Ebenezer Denny returned to Pittsburgh, where he had a number of friends, and which he saw as a city with a future. He resigned from the service, and would go on to a highly successful banking career in Pittsburgh, and was to become the city's first mayor. St. Clair would eventually be exonerated from blame for what happened, by Washington, and by a committee of the House of Representatives, which praised his bravery under fire. He was also to remain the governor of the territory. But the horrors and disgrace of St. Clair's defeat were not forgotten, nor would the fact that the military situation, even before the campaign got underway, was hopeless. One bad decision by St. Clair as commander followed another, starting with that of proceeding with the campaign in the first place. Far better it would have been to have abandoned the whole thing, just as he had once abandoned Fort Ticonderoga. Then, too, the timing had been off. It all got going too late in the year, and no one, it would appear, including Washington and Knox, seemed capable of learning from the disastrous experience of General Harmer. On the morning of February 1st, 1792, Winthrop Sargent rode by horseback with a small detachment of soldiers, combining a burial party to the scene of the slaughter. As he wrote, the memory of the disaster that filled his mind bore no resemblance to the scene before him. The whole melancholy theater was covered with 20 inches of snow, yet with every tread of the horse's hooves, dead bodies were exposed to view. Mutilated, mangled, and butchered, with the most savage barbarity. And indeed, there seems to have been left no act of indecent cruelty or torture which was not practiced on the occasion, to the women as well as the men. Looking over the lay of the ground, he thought, it, as an encampment, very strong and certainly defensible, had it been held by regular troops. However, the dense woods, thick bushes, and old logs in such abundance close by were exactly the ideal cover for an Indian attack. What struck him most, riding around the line, was the amazing effect of the enemy's fire. Every twig and bush seems to be cut down, and the saplings and larger trees marked with the utmost profusion of their shot. Removing the bodies proved extremely slow and difficult. It was not just that they were buried in deep snow and had to be uncovered, but were frozen hard down to the ground and would break to pieces when being torn loose. The solemn task and rendering last rites would require more than a day. 5. Wasting no time in taking what were considered the steps necessary to carry on the campaign against the Indians, President Washington used the unfortunate affair of St. Clair's defeat to press Congress into increasing the size of the army as well as military pay, a program that would cost the government more than $1 million, a colossal sum. And this time, the necessary preparations and training were to be gone about in the right way. The one great, still unanswered question was, who would take command? Also in Philadelphia at this time were the Reverend Manasseh Cutler and Rufus Putnam, too, who had come as representatives of the Ohio Company to lobby Congress for an additional land grant and a reduction in land prices as a way of compensating for the economic fallback the company was suffering because of the Indian Wars. Most encouraging had been the reception they received from many members of Congress, and in particular, from Vice President John Adams. On the evening of March 4, 1792, Cutler was invited to dine with Adams and his family at their home on Bush Hill, overlooking the Schuylkill River. When I came to his house, I found that Mrs. Adams was dangerously sick with a fever, Cutler wrote to his wife Mary. He told me he refused all invitations to dine abroad and that he received no formal company at home, but very politely desired me to come and take a family dinner with him every day while I was in the city. In short, to make his house my home. The day following, Cutler called again at the Adams home to inquire after Mrs. Adams, and wound up spending the next several hours closeted with the vice president, talking about Ohio Company issues and more. As he reported to his wife, it gave me much pleasure that I had this favorable opportunity to mention to him General Putnam as a proper officer to command the force to be raised and sent against the Indians. He is much dissatisfied with the conduct of St. Clair and highly approves of the command being given to Putnam. Adams then encouraged Cutler, at earliest opportunity, to converse with General Knox, as well as members of the Senate and House, about Putnam. It seems to have been an especially active day for Cutler, who later ran into General St. Clair, whom he described as now hearty and well, and, from some of what he said, seemed to presume he would continue in command. It is said that the people in the Western country universally wish Putnam may take command, and I believe, were it to be decided by Congress, he would have a generous vote, Cutler also noted. The problem was Putnam. He does not wish for it. As Putnam made clear in a letter to Secretary of War Knox, he had not the remotest wish to enter again into military service. His private affairs and family situation forbade it, not to say his advanced age. The decision was finally made by Washington in mid-April 1792. The man in command this time was to be Anthony Wayne, General Mad Anthony Wayne, who had a reputation for the tenacity and aggressiveness needed to lead an army, and was anything but mad. One anecdote about Putnam's health problems at this time that he loved to tell concerned the return trip he made back up the Ohio that September, after concluding a treaty of peace with the Wabash and Illinois Indians. While on his barge rowed by U.S. soldiers, he suffered an attack of severe fever and ague. A doctor also on board debarred him from all food and drink. When they put ashore to camp for the night, and the others treated themselves to a banquet of bear meat, venison, and turkey, the very fumes of which were a feast, Putnam lay as peaceably as his cravings would allow. But when at last the rest of the party was asleep, he crept to the camp kettle and feasted on what remained of the bear meat and venison, and, as he later loved to report, he experienced no more of the fever and ague. The cloud of fear that had hung over Marietta and its neighboring settlements ever since the Big Bottom Massacre had begun to clear to a degree. Word had come down the Ohio from Pittsburgh of the new army being recruited and properly trained under General Wayne to settle the threat of Indian attacks once and for all. An army said to number 8,000 men. By early spring 1793, the army was on its way, and if numbering closer to 2,000, it was there to be seen passing by on flatboats downriver to Fort Washington at Cincinnati. Difficult as they had been, the years of confinement at Campus Martius had given rise to a very different way of life, and, to the surprise of many, what evolved had proven quite enjoyable. To enliven the off hours within the stockade, a variety of games and sporting events, foot races, boxing matches, had become a mainstay in which old and young engaged. Dancing was another diversion practiced by the youth, and encouraged by their elders as affording healthy exercise in which females could take part. No distinctions of family or official positions were then made. All activities were open to everyone. As would be written, they were united in bonds of friendship like one great family, bound and held together in a common brotherhood by the perils which surrounded them. In after years, when each household lived separate in their own domicile, they looked back on these days with satisfaction and pleasure, as a period in their lives when the best affections of the heart were called forth and practiced towards each other. The absence of a single violin in the garrison to enliven events was made up for by an elderly man, a sailor in his youth, known as Uncle Sam, who, with the aid of the enlivening beverage, could sing all night, often tiring out the dancers sooner than they him. When, before daylight, he became a bit drowsy, a few kind words and another dram set him going again. Some worried this change in the settlement's way of life would have long-range detrimental effect, but they were a decided minority. One year later came word from the northwest corner of Ohio on the lower Maumee River that on August 20th, 1794, General Wayne and his army had won an overwhelming victory over some 2,000 native warriors, again led by Blue Jacket, at the Battle of Fallen Timbers. Unlike the forces under General Arthur St. Clair, Wayne's troops, foot soldiers and cavalry, fought with great discipline and fury, and though the Indians, too, fought with great bravery, they were quickly routed. Wayne's losses were minor, 33 killed, about 100 wounded, while the losses by Blue Jacket's warriors were twice that. The victory, as Rufus Putnam said, was decisive. Its importance could scarcely be overestimated. It ended more than 4 years of bitter frontier fighting. At Marietta, the cloud of fear lifted at last. The settlers could come out of their blockhouses and return to their farms or trades at their pleasure. The entire community could get on with much that needed doing. In another year, on August 3, 1795, American officials and scores of Indian representatives signed the Treaty of Greenville, establishing a treaty line above which, north and west of the line, the Indians were confined. As the noted Ohio historian George W. Knepper was to write, compared to any previous effort to separate Indian and white in Ohio, the Treaty of Greenville was effective, though at the Indians' expense. It opened the way in eastern and southern Ohio for a renewed flood of settlers anxious to clear and cultivate lands that had never known the axe and the plow.